Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views with Chris Fitzsimon.
Welcome back to News and Views. Now that the North Carolina Supreme Court has upheld the state's school voucher scheme, voucher supporters are pushing to expand the program, while others are trying to make the program more accountable to the taxpayers. Here to talk about what's next for vouchers and the battle over who will oversee charter schools in the state is Matt Ellenwood with the North Carolina Justice Center. Well, Matt, thanks for being back with us on News and Views. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
A lot to talk about in the education world. I guess one of the bigger stories in the last few weeks was the decision by the North Carolina Supreme Court to uphold the state's voucher program, the Opportunity Scholarships Program. I wondered what your thoughts are on the decision and what happens now.
The decision wasn't super surprising in that it broke on kind of the political leanings of the justices, and it was always going to be kind of a 50-50 call. It was a 4-3 decision, very close. I think since it's a novel interpretation of the Constitution, not super surprising that it was that close and that there's some controversy over it. We think that the original decision got it right, obviously, that it's hard to have a public purpose, which is something that everything in the Constitution requires, that all, you know, taxpayer money be spent with a public purpose. And when you're spending it on something private like this that really lacks any accountability features to the public, we don't think it can meet that requirement. So I think moving forward, what we're hoping will happen is that the program will become more accountable. No one has really worked to refine it or improve it over the past year, given its legal status. And so I think it's time to start thinking about what are some accountability measures we can put on it to make sure that there's not fraud and abuse, for one, but also that we know how students are doing, how they're performing. We can compare them to the traditional public schools and see what kind of impact the program is having.
It's interesting. There hasn't been a lot of discussion outside of the court case about what accountability is missing and what's really there. How accountable are the schools, the voucher schools?
Right. Well, I think it's useful to look at other states that have had the program for longer, that have had a voucher program operating. There's some places like Milwaukee and Cleveland that have had it for about 20 years, and Indiana's had it for longer than we have, maybe going back 4 or 5 years. Those places end up having, you have to take the state test. In North Carolina, you just have to take a nationally normed test. It doesn't have to be any particular test. So that makes it almost impossible to compare the performance of voucher students to traditional public school students. In other states, they'll have them take the state test so they can make that kind of comparison. Indiana recently passed a law that requires the voucher schools to put out a school report card similar to what the public schools put out, that not only has information about test scores, but also what are the class sizes, student-teacher ratios, what are the qualifications of teachers, what's the safety climate. It has all kinds of information in there about, you know, things like AP offerings. There's a standard state curriculum, but what extra offerings do they have? So that provides a lot more information to parents. I think that's what we hear a lot about vouchers, is that there's accountability to the parents. But there can really only be accountability to the parents if the parents are informed about what's happening in the school. And at this point, we really lack that.
Another big issue in the education world is the continuing battle over what to do about charter schools, expansion, regulation. And there's a bill moving through the legislature now that would actually take oversight of charter schools out of the Department of Public Instruction and give it to the State Board of Education. What do you think of that idea?
We don't know why that was even suggested as an idea. So it's from a policy perspective, it's hard to say what the purpose of that would be. There's not a huge separation between what happens in DPI and the State Board. They're not one entity technically, but they do function together in there. And so it's not a huge change. I think it just sort of speaks to this break within the charter school movement, really, that there's two different ways of looking at it. And I think the legislature is more on the side of let's approve all of the schools possible and then let the market take care of it. The bad schools will close and the better schools will stay open. I think there's a concern that DPI maybe isn't on that page, but I think it's anybody who's in the position of having to approve a charter school, they have to deal with the reality of that this is a school that needs to serve children. And if it fails, then those children will have lost an opportunity to receive an education for an entire year. It can have a big impact on the community. The schools will often come back and try to sue the state board to remain open. So it's a complex and lengthy procedure. So it's a little different. Once you're in that, I think that there's been an ongoing effort by the legislature going back a few years to try to make more charter schools get approved, to make the approval process a little easier. But when you're in that position of being the approver, you've got a lot to take into account. And what you don't want to see is the school closing in a year or two and coming back to you because of all of the angst that can cause in the community. So I think there's just that tension there of, do we want to make sure that the schools are ready to open and are going to serve students really well, or do we want to just let all the schools open and then let the market take care of it?
We've seen some schools that have struggled and closed for various reasons, I guess primarily financial oversight. It's interesting that there are still people, Senator Tillman and others in the legislature, who still think there are too many regulations on charter schools.
I don't know why that is. I mean, I think that basically what they're most of the regulations deal with outcomes, and then there's federal laws. So there's sort of no way to get out of things like the federal laws around students with disabilities, which charter schools sometimes do have trouble complying with because they don't provide things like transportation. And there's sort of questions, what if you have an IEP, an individualized education program, and you need transportation and you're a student with disability, then you go to a charter school that doesn't offer it. So they can get regulated in those types of ways, but that's never going to go away. So I think that they do have all kinds of flexibility. It's just that the biggest issue they seem to have is if they open and they aren't ready to serve the right number of students, then they're not going to have enough money to keep going. And that's the main thing the Office of Charter Schools is really looking at. So they're not picking on them saying, oh, you need to have this or that education plan or mission statement or anything like that. What they're really mainly looking at is, will the school be financially viable? And if the answer is no, they're not going to open it. So I don't think that there's really that difficult of a bar to clear to open a charter school.
The big education issue, other than sort of the charters and vouchers, is the budget, which is the big issue every year. As we sit here, there is no state budget. Schools open in less than 3 weeks. What kind of strain does that put on schools, and what's really at stake in this battle between the House and the Senate?
The strain is huge. I think that you can imagine if you're a school and you're running a district, then you don't know whether you're going to have a huge number of TAs lost and you're going to have to go out and hire teachers, because the Senate budget has, you know, gets rid of over 8,000 teaching assistant positions and uses them for some smaller number of teachers to reduce class size. And the House budget keeps things the way they are. So that's very confusing if you're trying to run a school where you don't know who, you need to know who the personnel are going to be in your school, you know, when you're operating a few days ahead of time. And it's like that pretty much, or you need to know it months ahead of time, not a few days ahead of time. It's like that through every item of the budget. If you look at something like textbooks, there's different amounts in the two different versions of the budget, so you don't know how much you can spend on textbooks. And these are all things that you'd want to have squared away already by now. That's why the budget, I think, is due at the end of June, is because of this.
What do you make of the big battle over teacher assistance? It seems every year this is an issue that has either held up the budget or been a major difference between the two budgets.
I think that there's a value to having small class size, obviously. The research is really strong that once you start getting down to having about 16 students per class in a high-quality teacher, that teacher can make a really significant impact on students' education. And you can see that they'll move ahead by more months of it, you know, in terms of learning each year than if you were in a larger class. So that's really important. What confuses me is why it always has to be at the expense of teaching assistants, because there's also really strong research around, again, similar to the small class size research, one-on-one instruction, small group work, that having students work in groups that are sort of supervised by multiple adults in the classroom is a really effective mechanism. And I think that makes some intuitive sense that you'd want to have as much individualized instruction as you possibly can have. So it's easy to say, yeah, we want to have both, but it only makes sense. I think that the research is really strong around each.
How will this be decided?
I don't know. I mean, at this point, it's so late. We're so far into the process, so close to when school opens, that I don't think that you could have it where you have to get rid of all the TAs and go back to and hire more teachers. I think that either things will stay the way they are, or there'll be just a lot of flexibility in the way it's written. So districts will be given money for X number of positions in teaching assistants and teachers, but there's so much flexibility in the way they're allowed to spend that money that they'll just sort of spend it on whichever one of those two things that they want.
One issue we haven't heard much about this session, even though it's very important and you've talked a lot about it in your work, which is the importance of pre-K and early childhood to make sure kids are ready to learn. It's interesting that hasn't been a big budget battle this year, and yet we still have a waiting list every year for at-risk four-year-olds.
You're right, and we serve about 25% fewer students in that program than we did back in 2010, and which is really amazing considering over that period the volumes of research that have come out expounding the value of pre-K nationally, and also how heavily evaluated North Carolina's pre-K program has been, as it's consistently ranked as one of the top three in the nation. It's really one of the kind of the strengths of our education system. It's one of the best things we've got going. So you'd think you'd want to grow it rather than contract it. And again, even this year is no different, where the Senate version of the budget does cut it and the House version maintains it. But, you know, the cost of running the program goes up each year. It's going to be really tricky to keep the program at its current size under either version of the budget. And under the Senate version, it would certainly be, you know, contracted even further, which is just really hard to get your mind wrapped around, given all of the strong research around this particular program.
Well, thanks, as always, for all that you're doing, and we appreciate you being with us.
Thank you.
That's it for another edition of News and Views. Look for us on the web at ncpolicywatch.com. For producer Clayton Hinkle, this is Chris Fitzsimon. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.
You've been listening to News and Views with Chris Fitzsimon, director of North Carolina Policy Watch. Visit them online at ncpolicywatch.com. News and Views, a weekly look at state and policy issues, is a production of the North Carolina Justice Center.